Are you all through scoring the test? Those of you who aren't, can you sort of either wait for a pause to continue doing this or do it right through the conversation? Once you get to the toward the end of the test, you sort of figure out that the pluses mean minus, the minuses mean plus, but it's a little tricky, especially when you have to keep looking back at the first page for the key. Any surprises as people are looking at their own tests? Just anybody just go, well, I never expected to find this. Some surprises. That's been my experience taking this test, that it has a way of breaking down the components of, particularly around issues around our self-concept, where the self-concept is not in harmony with what it means to be a fully functioning human being. I mean, that's really what this is all about. That, in fact, and we're going to talk about some of these categories, what we'll find is that sort of in the heart of those areas of which we're the most vulnerable, we usually have, in many cases, what we would call, fairly high idealistic kinds of expectations. But when you're looking at issues of self-esteem and the self-concept, what we have discovered is that it's those very high, what we think is just, wouldn't this be a wonderful person, goals that, in fact, because they are so impossible, make it impossible for us to continue to have a solid kind of sense of ourselves and a feeling that we are okay, because the world is just set out to see that some of these things aren't going to happen. And as I think we'll talk about these sort of category by category and see, it's like where are the areas in which we're most likely to be on the erroneous side, and how can we rework some of those belief systems so that we are in fact kinder to ourselves. All right, the first one on approval. Someone just, from looking at the summary paragraph on approval, talk about what are the issues about approval for self-esteem. We can either have someone for whom approval isn't a problem, or you could read it because you go, oh God, there I go again. Okay. Anybody? What's the issue for self-esteem around approval? Does that make us vulnerable, looking for other people's approval?
Makes us dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really putting our sense of ourselves in other people's hands rather than our own.
Yes. What happens in terms of functioning? I mean, like what happens in the role of a parent if you need approval from others?
Probably make you slightly ineffective until you get it before you do something, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have you ever tried to, pull approval from a toddler or a 2-year-old or a teenager?
Yeah.
There may be a couple years in there when the kids will think you're just darling. Like the same number of years that you thought they were just darling, I suppose. They don't always happen at the same time. And yet, isn't it true that so much of our programming has to do with, it's like we in fact sort of measure whether or not we're doing well by the approval of others. So it's one of those things that at some point we cross a line where approval for some stages and in some parts of our development is a clue about how we're functioning and whether or not we're going to be socially effective and whether or not we're going to make it. And there are whole systems built up that say that the external approval is what's going to keep you going. I mean, school systems certainly are built on that. Some work systems are built on that. And yeah, the irony of that is that if we are too dependent on the approval of people outside of ourselves, then we don't have, there's no way you can really manage that. And in fact, to do a good job in whatever you're called upon to do, you almost always have to face, pockets of disapproval.
That is try asking 5 people if they approve of something you do and see if you can get a consistent answer if you want to make yourself crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any other comment or a reflection just on the issue of approval? Approval is one of those that very often, at least in terms of sex role stereotype, is often harder for women than for men. So there may be more women in the room for whom approval is an area around which they are more vulnerable. But again, not necessarily. You know, those are not necessarily true.
Mine was zero.
Mm-hmm.
I found that kind of interesting, and I also wondered if that reflects my tendency towards indecision.
Well, if you mean lots of your scores were zero, your score on the approval one was zero.
On approval.
Oh, because you wrote neutral all the time.
Yeah.
You wrote neutral a lot.
Yeah.
What do you think that means about approval? How important do you think the approval of others is to you? Like, without, you know, trying to worry about the questions on the test, what would you say?
I suppose sometimes it depends on the situation.
Well, maybe that's why you had trouble, because maybe in order to answer the test, you have to sort of put yourself in one mindset, and then answer each of those questions. I mean, you didn't know ahead of time that it was the first five, but answer each of those questions based on that mindset. And I think that's a good question. That whenever we take these tests, whether we take them, you know, here or in classes or out of the Parade magazine, the mindset that you use makes a big difference. And most of us are in many, many, many roles. What some people will find is that there are some roles that we act out whereby our self-esteem is in better shape than in other roles. So the mindset that you use, the framework that you use, could make a big difference for that. So if in fact you're trying to sort of cover the whole territory and you find yourself pretty often indecisive, then I'd recommend that when you go back and take the test, you say, okay, now I'm going to think about myself at work, or I'm going to think about myself in terms of my family, or I'm going to think about myself in terms of my friends, or, you know, however you would like to do that as a way, again, to maybe pinpoint some areas around which, so that you can move off the zero. If your question is, you know, don't I have any opinion about this? Okay, good. Very good question. Are there any other comments around the issue of approval? Or you won't even want to look at those five questions and say, why are they asking this? Like, what's that all about? Anyone say, this doesn't make sense to me?
I have a comment, generally speaking, on this whole thing. And I thought that the definitions that she used, I managed to get through omnipotence before we started.
Mm-hmm.
And they all seem to be... I don't know how to say it exactly. They all seem to be extreme.
Mm-hmm.
All of her definitions are extreme. She talks about the fact that a positive score from zero, between 0 and 10 indicates you're independent with a healthy sense of your own self-worth. Well, that's fine. Then they say that a negative score between 0 and negative 10 indicates you are excessively dependent. That means that a person with a score of 1 is a healthy self-image, and a person with a score of negative 1 is excessively...
Well, I think you need to see...
Assume
that she's using the whole range. Yeah, I mean, she didn't say, you know, from 0 to, you know, minus 1 to minus 3 means this much, and yeah. But you have to assume that that whole range, that the plus, the higher up the plus, the more that's not a problem for you, and the lower the negative is, the more that's an area of vulnerability. And for me, I think it's like, what's the intensity of your belief system around that particular issue? And I think for most of us, when we're working with issues of self-esteem, we're not sure quite what it is that gets us. And I think that's the only reason to break these down. Again, these categories are, I mean, they're for you to use and for you to remember. It's like, oh, when I read that statement, that wasn't what I was thinking. I mean, this is your test to use. I mean, so these are just categories. If this helps you to deal with with issues of self-esteem, good. If it isn't helpful, you know, disregard that or correct it. Yeah, I think you're right. You know, a minus 1 isn't a whole lot different from a plus 1. You know how it got scored. This isn't a mystery. So, yeah. Or a 0, you know. Okay. Good. Other questions or comments? Yeah, remember, you're always in control of the interpretation of this. This is your stuff. Okay. Any other questions or comments just around the whole area of approval? And I think it says to us something about how we are in relationship to other people. I remember when I first took, I think it's in the parent effectiveness training which I think was fairly popular in the 70s. There's the 12 no-nos somewhere in the back of the book or something, and it talked about praise as binding. Any of you remember that? That, in fact, when we praise people, it makes them dependent on our assessment of what they've done. For me, that was a brand new concept, that praise, instead of being freeing, instead of giving a person a bigger picture of him or herself, is in fact binding, so that ultimately, if that gets reinforced and reinforced, then someone always has to take their work to someone else. And if that work is not praised, then the person doesn't have a sense of that it's good. You know, that, so that always looking for external approval finally gets us in a bind rather than to help us see that we're really very competent people. And for me, that was a new thought at that time. I just, you know, I thought, geez, if you like what somebody's doing, tell them.
Well, and also, isn't it natural that if you like something that you've done, that you want to show that to someone else and say, hey, look what I did. I did a good job.
Well, that's the good part. It's like if you've already internalized that you've done something good and want to show someone, praise will do is it will meet your judgment or your assessment. And so it's not a problem. The problem is when someone never knows if they've done a good job until someone else from the outside says, you know, this is really excellent work. Because what we want to learn to do is how to use feedback from others as a way to measure our own assessment of that work. So, yeah, your example is that's a validation of the self that's already decided that. I have a friend who tells a story when my kids were in preschool. We had a real creative woman as the preschool teacher. And she went to visit my friend's house one day, and my friend was feeling real awkward about something in her house. I don't remember if it was a picture or something. And she was sort of embarrassed about it and just had the sense that Louise was just this wonderful artist, which she was. So Louise walks into Gail's house, and Gail, feeling sort of awkward, said, you know, well, how do you like that painting? And Louise said, well, how do you like it? How do you like it? It's like, you know, she was feeling awkward. She was sort of waiting for someone to say, oh, that's really an ugly thing. It's like, well, how do you like it? Which put it back on, you know, on Gail to figure out whether or not this was something that she should be either pleased about or not pleased about. So that place where we're unsure of ourselves is, and when we wait for the approval from others, it doesn't mean that if that's an issue for you, that you shouldn't, in fact, find ways to get some kind of assessment of your work. You know, find people who value you, who will help you assess what you're doing. Because we do need an approval mechanism, but the point is we want it, as adults, we want it to be internal. We want it inside. We don't always want it outside. You know, people in the work setting who are always furious because their boss doesn't, you know, pat them on the back, or the boss doesn't acknowledge their hard work or their good work. I mean, I know that it's an issue, but at some point, you know, who can follow everyone around? And, you know, there wouldn't be enough people around to notice how much good work we do. It just won't happen. So if you're always waiting, that would be a vulnerability just in terms of your managing yourself well. Okay? Another reflection on that issue of approval? Okay, the second one is love. Somebody want to just describe, you know, what's the self-esteem issue around love? Seems to me that in some ways this is sort of going for the heart of what we thought we believed. Like, what's the problem here?
Would that be you feel you're a likable person or an unlikable person?
Well, it's even more than that. It's about being lovable. So what's it really after? Why is the issue of love? Why do they say that people who are sort of seeking people to love them are love junkies? What's that about? I mean, the questions, I think, are real confusing. It's like, I mean, I think these are pretty basic kinds of things, 6 or 10. I cannot find happiness without being loved by another person. I mean, I've heard that. I mean, that just looks like good theology to me. Good theology. So, you know, that we in fact love because God first loved us, and we talk in terms of developmental psych about infants who in fact are not able to love unless they were first loved. So they're not talking about that. But it seems to me that this is real confusing, that very often we do measure whether or not we are loved, that is lovable, what if we can name somebody who loves us. And pretty soon the person with the name who's supposed to love us doesn't love us. Whoops, there it goes. Right? I mean, I do think that. I mean, I think this is a tough one. I think we're, you know, both in the culture and I think in the faith, really conditioned to think that we have to know the name of the person who loves us, and that if their love goes away, we become unlovable. All right, is that? How do other people read this?
I read it as meaning of, you know, an intimate other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it referred to, rather than a parent or something like that.
Oh, so it won't even work? I mean, you've got to have an intimate relationship with someone. Or
that's how I read what, mm-hmm. what she was getting at. Mm-hmm.
What does that do then to our self-esteem or our self-concept?
Well, you always got to have somebody. You always have to have a man or you always have to have a woman in order to feel okay.
Mm-hmm. And then goodness knows how we, you know, we define all sorts of behaviors as not loving us, don't we? It's like disagreeing on sort of major decisions. Well, you don't love me anymore. That makes even the love relationship too vulnerable. I mean, you just can't pull that off. And yet I think that in many ways we really define whether or not we are lovable or loved by the quality of the external lover rather than something about ourselves, which is just sort of in our nature, like the who we are stuff. Yeah. Any other questions or reflections on this? I can't get this far enough away from my face to read much.
I have problems with the term happiness partly because I find different levels of happiness. I find pleasure and I find happiness. I find pleasure in being loved by other people, but I find my happiness in the unconditional love that I feel from God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I know is always there.
Mm-hmm.
So whether anyone else in the world ever accepts me or not, I've always got that love, so that's
yeah.
where I see theology coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from that love and from my security in that love springs the love for everybody else.
Yeah.
But it's not required of them.
Okay. Yeah, I think we need to be able to tolerate all sorts of both styles and conditions of love between human beings, which makes it possible even to deal with differences and not feel threatened at our very core. And so this makes it makes it real important in terms of our self-concept or self-esteem.
You know, I work with kids that, I see a lot of kids every day that don't have any love in their life. And they,
mm-hmm.
They certainly don't look like people that I'd like to be with or around or like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care for any of this definition on love, this woman or person, I don't know.
It's a man or a woman.
Okay.
It says copyright
on it. Well, anyway, I just don't care for it.
You don't like the definition of love?
No, I don't. It bothers me. It's when I read this, I radiate a healthy sense of self-love. I don't see that as being a positive attribute. A positive sense of self-love radiating says that somebody has an ego problem.
Oh. Okay.
And it seems to me that if you read her, or the person's love, meaning male, female, if you're 22 and you're not married, mind you, what's wrong with you? Because her statement of love is not a requirement for happiness or self-esteem, I think the love junkie problem can be someone who needs what they view as a completely fulfilling one-on-one relationship, whereby people may choose to define their families maybe a little less traditionally than that's always been done. And there's a great deal of love in those bonds that is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe part of the the love should be in quotes, and maybe she's talking about a more strong physical infatuation as opposed to, you know, to love.
Okay, are you going to say something? No? No. Okay. Is there another reflection or assessment of...
I will see this woman's definition of love as more as approval rather than love, seeking approval rather than seeking love.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is. It is certainly is love in the sense of affirmation from outside of ourselves by another person. So it's stronger, more intense, more intimate than her definition of approval. Mm-hmm. But that's what she's after, and that's what
and
she
most
says.
Most likely on a one-on-one situation rather than just anybody in particular or a group being approved.
Well, she says, anyway, as you see people drift away from you, so I don't know that it's particularly only one person that it's focused on, but it wouldn't just be friendship. Okay? Right. Yeah.
I guess I don't know if I see that it's so wrong that we do desire to be loved and that we desire to be lovable people, and that it is in love of other people that brings out our strengths and our weaknesses that perhaps we can't see ourselves. I know that's true for me. You know, other people have been able to reaffirm things or bring things out. And so I just personally don't see it as being particularly unhealthy to desire to be loved, not as a selfish thing or dependent thing, but just as a more sharing thing, a more growing thing for yourself and for others.
And I think your description of that love relationship is one that is described with a healthy self concept. I mean, your description is not like the love junkie that she describes here, who if no one loves them, they're gone. They've just lost themselves.
The difference between want and need.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what she talks about here, there's an organization called Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous or something like that. It's based on the same principles as AA. Mm-hmm. But it's a people either who go through a whole series of relationships and just, you know, are always on the prowl, if you are always cruising. And then there are or people who have very, very intense relationships that they exhaust and break up, and then they're devastated, and then immediately to get involved in another one. And I think that that's the kind of thing she's, and an extreme kind of thing.
I think that's right. I think that's what she's talking about. Yeah, I don't think this is a recommendation that people who have real important love relationships, that those are not important, but that you don't lose your sense of yourself when that, you know, when that reflection of you goes away. Okay? The third one is achievement. Does anybody want to reflect on that issue of achievement? Okay.
I like being a workaholic.
Is that how you can't? Did you turn out of the test to be a workaholic?
Yeah, not as well as I probably should have.
Well, that's maybe you're still redeemable.
You gave me too much of one if you're here.
Yeah, what's the issue around achievement and around in terms of self-esteem? What's the test trying to highlight?
That you tie your self-esteem onto a material thing, you know, like what you can produce or how well you can do.
Mm-hmm. Which again, doesn't mean that you shouldn't do well. See. These are not things that mean that, you know, you should stop doing what you're doing, particularly if it has value. But does it in fact mean that if you work on a project and it's just a bust, that you can't separate your self, you know, esteem from the failure of that project? And that's the issue around achievement, that we link our sense of ourself with the product, you know, with that project being done well, or with an A on a test, or you know, with with those kinds of activities. It doesn't mean that we don't continue to do good work. Many people, like the studies around entrepreneurs lately, is that entrepreneurs will have many, many, many failures and many, many, many successes, because they never get confused about the success of the project with their own success. Those people, the studies on entrepreneurs is that they have very strong self-concepts, and they always find some other way to understand why that project didn't work as a way to save themselves. And sometimes it's, you know, wholly accurate. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a matter of just keeping some distance from it. Actually, in terms of self-esteem, that's what this says, that we need to keep some distance even from the things we do well, so that they don't define us. And so that when we don't do them well, we don't lose ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that's why so many people have problems in retirement, is when they've really tied that to their achievement, and all of a sudden they quit work, and you hear people about dropping dead of a heart attack 2 days later or something, that their work has become themselves, and once they quit work, they don't have an identity anymore?
I do think that that's really highly related. Yeah. And again, see, you know, we have whole systems that want people to do that. It isn't as if, you know, we whooped this up out of our, you know, some 12-year-old fantasy and we've been carrying it out of our imagination. You know, there's lots of systems that want us to tie ourselves pretty closely to our work.
The capitalistic system is based on it. Mm-hmm. The whole work ethic is based on it. That's why women live longer. I'm convinced of that, because they don't retire at 65. I mean, they've been housewives and mothers all their lives. Because their vocation doesn't change.
But I'll bet you still that, referring back to that, that age gap is going to be closer.
Oh, yeah, it is. But yeah, sure. We now see it. Most 65-year-old women today, you know, have been, I mean, the majority of them.
Also, it might be of interest at how many women there are in this room as opposed to men, too, as far as trying to get a handle on this kind of a situation.
Good. That's sort of the flip side of what Jim just said.
Yeah.
It's like, it may in fact be a stronger issue for men. Women may simply deal with it all the time, may try to integrate that all the time. Okay, yeah, I do think it has to do with self-definition. It's like boys and men are told from you know, time they are young, and they have fathers and uncles who in fact are defined by their work. Women, even women who work, often are also, you know, mothers, and define themselves often as spouses. And so the multiplicity of roles keeps this one from being quite so tough. But you can see this sometimes with if a parent defines themselves by how well the kids turn out, then maybe the very same thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not very healthy either for the parent or for the kid. So achievement orientation isn't only a male problem, but it's probably, again, this is probably more male, same way the approval issue is probably more female. Okay, next one is the perfectionism. Anybody want to summarize the issue of being perfect? And why that's such a tough one to pull off? Isn't so hard? And somebody say, isn't so hard? You don't have any trouble?
Not a perfection. I teach math, and I make, you know, if I don't make 10 or 12 mistakes in front of 30 or 40 people, period. You know.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They would stop paying attention, ultimately.
Oh, they don't stop. They just look at mistakes.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. That gets them to pay attention.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. It's a whole lot easier to be a kid for a teacher who's not perfect than it is to be a kid for a teacher who's, you know, who's a little open. Yeah, makes some mistakes, and they go, ah. We found that one.
You wouldn't survive as a teacher if you were a perfectionist.
No.
You
could.
Get it.
Chop you up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know, it seems to me, at least you read a lot about, you know, supermom, you know, full-time plus career, and of course, you know, gourmet, made from, you know, home-ground flour from scratch.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And there you recycle and everything. And, you know, I think some of those questions aren't quite addressed by what is listed here.
No, but culturally, that's a nice addition to that. You're right.
You really have to work hard not to buy into that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are subtle ways for us to be perfectionists that somehow doesn't come on the perfection side. It just means be sure to do everything well. Yeah, even be sure to do everything well is a heavy burden. Okay, how about entitlement? Okay, question.
Is it possible to sort of be at two levels on this? Because I grew up in a very perfectionistic home, and I am aware of those tendencies in myself. Yet I came out on this fairly healthy. But I think it's sort of, in my head, I know some things. But I think on an emotional level, I'm still...
Are you fighting that one?
Yeah.
Graham? Well, that's good that you would notice that. And what that usually means is that you're still working for some kind of integration to that. I mean, I think if you're at least that far along, you're more on the healthy side than on the unhealthy side. So keep it up.
Yeah, every once in a while I have to tell myself this isn't as important as I'm making it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Is everything you knit perfect?
No.
You wear it still?
What?
You wear it still?
Oh, listen, I haven't knit in years. This is my first project in 15 years.
Yeah. And you
would. You're wearing your mistakes. And even yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other comments on that one? How about the entitlement one? Were you going to come in?
Well, I don't know if this got addressed because I did come a little bit late, but I was wondering if it'd be interesting to see how one reacted when they were under stress as compared to when they're comfortable in their milieu. I would expect that people emotionally might react very differently under stress when it's old. Because what struck me is on the perfectionism scale, shoot, I'm as healthy as can be. I read the description of myself and I thought, no, I'm not.
I just fooled myself on the front page. Huh?
Exactly, and then I went back over the questions and I would ask, I completely agree with how I filled them out. So I'm thinking, I agree with the woman talking about the two levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually what will happen is that the one that you're sort of low on or not as high on as the others will be the one that will get you when you're under stress. But if your scores are all fairly even when you take it in a relaxed setting, then you might want to go back and say, okay, how did I handle this last time the shit hit the fan?
Is this a relaxed setting?
Holden Village?
Yeah. I'm not here doing this. My scores go from making 6 to 9.
Uh huh. I think that's all. I mean that seems like a normal range. Yeah. Yeah. I think what Pete is saying is that if you've dealt with yourself more gently on this than it's the same issue you're talking about. Then the way you would get at your most vulnerable areas. See, I think the reason you take this at a time when you're not under stress is so that you know where you're going to be the most vulnerable. And you can usually catch those blips. It's like getting a physical exam once a year, and doctor can see, watch out for this one. And you want to start doing that for yourself. Okay. How about what's the issue of entitlement? You may want to describe that.
It kind of seems to me that it deals a lot with humility versus pride, as in the negative and the positive. And that a positive, positive score saying you don't feel automatically entitled to things really seems to be an issue of humility, not as in meekness, but humility and just, hey, whatever happens, happens. And you do things without expectations of getting things back. Whereas you disentitled, well, I do this well, I should get this back.
Okay, I see. That kind of humility. Yeah. It's like the world ought to be sort of a tit-for-tat thing. If I do this, then I ought to get this back. Okay. Anybody else?
Also, things tend to become gifts if you're not expecting them. In a political sense, when I could let go of things like expectations, Christmas gifts, birthday gifts, things that you expect your children to do, if you don't have those high expectations, then everything is sort of kind of a little joy that you just got because.
Yeah.
I think of it as a strong ego, someone that feels entitled, right? A strong ego.
Ego as in?
Conceit. feeling entitled.
Uh-huh.
They're good enough, they're too good. Or...
It often reflects a passive style, too, that it's just sort of out of my being, you know, the goodness of the earth ought to be coming to me. I think that it's because it doesn't connect anything you do with anything you get. I mean, there's no cause and effect about your own behavior, that somehow all these things ought to just come to you, that it reflects... I think the strong ego is right. It's like, of course they'll give me credit for this. Of course I'll do well. Or just a very passive style. Somebody else will take care of this for me. Yeah. You don't have to teach your children how to give gifts. They'll just do it. I had that one on cleaning the house. Yeah. Thought they would just do it because we all lived in the same place. Well, that's not very realistic. And it's not very helpful. And it certainly wasn't helpful to my self-esteem.
And you see the same thing in the same person, someone who thinks everything is owed to them, but they don't have to clean up their own messes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's related to entitlement.
Okay. Kid walking around with his hand up.
What?
That's your kid walking around with his hand up.
Yeah, like they get something and then they expect something more. But we ought to think about how that functions as adults.
Huh, so I related entitlement to the word expectations.
Yeah. Okay. How about the omnipotence one? I think this is related to if you can't do anything well, don't do anything at all. Anybody, the omnipotence issue touch anybody here?
I think it's more recognizable, or at least it was to me, as sort of a rescuer complex, that if I have someone in my family that's feeling badly, that it's up to me to fix it and make them feel better and make them smile. And I have never written the word omnipotence because that sounds like too, you know, He-Man, and I'm just going to make them feel better, but it's the same trap.
It is the same trap. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, I think there's a lot, again, I think it's a confused kind of an ethic that says we are in fact responsible. We are our neighbor's keeper. You know, we're responsible for the feelings of other people, for the lives of other people. Again, we certainly are interdependent, but we are not responsible, particularly for the issue of feelings. I think that's talked about more here than anything else. And I mean, I think most people get into this at some point, that they really believe that it's that if they've done something and there's some sort of a negative response, something that they would call a negative response on the other side, then they shouldn't have done what they did. You know, and that kind of trying to control another person's affect or response by minimizing your own response, essentially. It's about all you can do to be omnipotent is to have no activity at all. It's a real diminishing kind of issue in terms of self-esteem. And it looks, you know, grandiose. So it's tricky.
What about if you always seem to fall into that category where someone is always, you know, seems to come to you and you have to be there to solve the problem. So.
Well, what are you asking about?
Isn't it when you take on kind of somebody else's problems and you think that maybe you can solve them better than they can themselves?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I feel sometimes that I'm pressed into that role.
Well, sure, because somebody who comes to you might be on this side. You know, they might think, good, if I just tell my problems to somebody else, she'll deal with it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can find somebody else with a self-esteem problem on another side who will use the fact that, you know, the difference between being a good listener, which is a good skill and which is a gift, and being that person's problem solver. They're not the same things. So you might want simply to learn how to be a good listener if you find yourself in this kind of a position often, so that you keep giving the problem back to the person who's brought it to you, that you get yourself out of the omnipotent stance.
It's called the monkey on the back syndrome if you're going up the management scale, because what happens is somebody brings you a problem and you're skilled, you just take it, and all of a sudden you get this big stack of monkeys on your desk and you have to deal with them because it's no longer their problem.
Mm-hmm. And it's because you really believe you're the one who can handle it best.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which you know, it's like ironically, I think that's a problem. It's a lot of people think that sort of people who are arrogant or conceited, I mean, those are really problems of low self-esteem. You know, not self-esteem that's too high. What's the issue around autonomy? Why is the issue of autonomy an issue that's related to self-esteem? The last one. Any? You know, we also have a belief system that says, you know, no one is an island. So what's this autonomy thing about?
Whether or not your well-being or feelings or goodness comes from you or from outside.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the approval again.
Yeah, approval is probably the one most similar to it, but it's any kind of real dependent state where something else needs to be happening in order for your self-esteem to be okay. No. And it's, unfortunately, we don't have that kind of control over the world, but we are meant to have that kind of control over ourselves. Now, it seems to me the thing that's important is that a person with a healthy self-concept still has a range of feelings about how things are going, still has a range of feelings, may in fact experience great grief, great joy, great disappointment, around all these things. You know, if you lose someone whom you've loved dearly, it doesn't mean that it doesn't matter. I mean, we're not saying when we're talking about self-esteem problems that these things don't matter. What we're saying is that we don't lose ourselves. We don't become so vulnerable that our person is diminished by not being perfect or not having a life as full as we would want it to be. In fact, I mean, if that happens, it's like the more diminished you are, the less you are able to rebound and go back and manage that issue, manage the problem. And that's a problem with self-esteem, is that when your self-esteem is down, then you don't have the internal resources to deal with the problem. And these mindsets are just, they are sure signs that when you can't pull this off, that you won't have the resources available. And that's what having a healthy self-concept is about. It doesn't mean that you don't deal with issues of failure. In fact, it makes it possible for you to deal with issues of failure. You know, it doesn't mean that you don't deal with issues of disappointment when the kids don't give you a birthday present. It means, in fact, you know, you can say to them, I'm really disappointed. But you don't have to, you know, feel diminished, nor do you have to totally hate them. You can talk about that range of feelings. I think this is tricky because people with low self-esteem are having feelings all the time. They're having terrible feelings about themselves. People with a healthy self-concept have feelings all the time too. But those feelings belong to them, and the range of feelings is much wider and much healthier. So it's not going to make you an unfeeling person. You know, it's not going to make you a person that's so self-contained that the world doesn't have any access to you. What happens is that you have more of a range of responses possible because you're still there for it. You don't totally lose yourself. Why don't you take a couple minutes? Again, you know, the test was for you, and you're welcome to either share or not share anything in these issues that you feel like doing. But I think it's important for people to get a chance to talk to others. Turn to somebody near you, introduce yourself, give them a first name, and then talk about which of these areas is the most vulnerable for you. I mean, even if all of your scores were above the line, there's an area that's the most vulnerable.